30th, 2014. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and tonight we present a panel discussion on the 22nd path of the Tree of Life, and that leads from Tipperith to Gomorrah. The path is attributed to the astrological sign Libra, the scales of balance, and the tarot trump justice, and the Hebrew and Phoenician letters Lamed, both representing the ox goad, which has a remarkable symbolism relating to a biblical Canaanite mystery we will reveal for the first time. This path also ends up at the narrow bridge leading to the castle on the edge of the abyss. That's Gomorrah, of course. And again, we refer to John Michael Greer's Paths of Wisdom and Gareth Knight's Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism. Now, if you want to meet Osiris in the Great Hall of Judgment, remember, like Santa Claus, he has a list of who's been naughty and who's been nice. So be good, for goodness sake. Now, I said it would be a panel discussion because I hope Frater Solomon calls in. In case you've forgotten our guest call-in number, it's 347-857-1830. Now, if anyone else would like to call in and discuss this path and or anything related to this path, this is the guest call-in number, 347-857-1830. Now, to begin with, let's set the stage like we do in these pathworking broadcasts. Take a little time to set the stage so those that are just catching up with us can kind of get an idea of what's going on, where we're at, and how we do it. This is, in our way of doing it, this is a working which starts out with Kusar's boat. Now, as I have described before, Kusar's boat, or Tubal-Cain's boat, is a magical device based upon Phoenician Canaanite mythology in which Tubal-Cain, Kusar and Kasus, who is analogous and sometimes interchangeable with Thoth Hermes of the Egyptians, the craftsman god, Hephaestus and Vulcan and whatever, the blacksmith god, the craftsman god, the engineer of the gods, so to speak. And he supposedly invented the fishing boat way, way back when the Phoenicians were not quite ready to put to sea in a big way, but they certainly were fishermen, and Kusar invented the fishing boat. And so what we have done is we have created a flying boat. It's a little boat that is shaped like a bird, except the wings are folded along the thwarts, and half of it is black and half of it is white. And it's black on the port side and white on the starboard side. And it has a beak like an ibis, so it looks like it could be called an ibis boat. It has a cockpit, it has a compass, and it has a rudder, and it has everything a boat needs, plus a couple of little platforms on the thwarts for candles for the color of the particular sphere that we're heading for. And we light those candles, put the boat on the altar, and we get into the boat using the power of our imagination, and we sail through the soul door or the dark mirror, and off we go to fly over the paths we have already walked. That's the purpose of Kusar's boat, is so we don't have to navigate the whole tree again from the Temple of Malkuth, the bottom. And this will take us over that which we have already covered, and we'll land at the base of the path, the upper path that we're going to try and trot on, and then we'll pick up the boat on the way back. It's a beautiful device, and you can see this device if you are associate member and you have our path working video. You can see this device pictured. Now, we would, in this case, we would fly Kusor's boat up to Tipperath, and we would, in this case, land past the pyramid in Tipperath, and we would pass the pyramid of transformation and sacrifice and whatever, and we would then embark on foot, taking the path 22, the path of justice, and walking our way up to Gabora, meeting the requirements of the path. Now, I want to read to you here all of the different basic attributes and all of this path as set forth in John Greer's Paths of Wisdom. This will get us oriented here. Path 22, the path of Lamed. The letter of the path is Lamed, and it represents the ox code. And as I said, it represents the ox code both in Hebrew and in earlier Phoenician. Now, the name of God is YHVH, or the Tetragrammaton. That's the name of God applied to the path. The astrological correspondence is Libra, the scales. The tarot correspondence is Trump 11, Justice. The esoteric title is the Daughter of the Lords of Truth, the Holder of the Balances. On the path text is the 22nd path, is the Faithful Intelligence, and is so-called because by it spiritual virtues are increased, and all dwellers on earth are yearly under its shadow. Pathological principle is the justice of heaven. The experiences of the path, narrow bridges and pathways, guarded gates and other barriers, images of duality and division, visions of past lives and their influence, trial before non-human judges. Entities of the path, angels, people from the past lives, gate guardians, magical image, an arch of emerald green bearing the letter Lamed in brilliant white upon its keystone. The door in the arch bears the image of a tarot trump. Colors in Etzeluth, emerald green and Bria blue, in Yetzirah, deep blue green, and in Ashiya, pale green. Now, that's the general gist of it. But let me make a few observations about these correspondences in relation to the path as we know it and the spirit goes to. The narrow bridge. Now, the way we conceive of Gabora is that it is a castle on a pinnacle of rock that is out on the edge of the abyss. And that's the abyss between the top three spheres of the tree and those beneath it, which some people interpret as the abyss between the Briatic dimension and the Azuric dimension, although that's an oversimplification. But this is, of course, going from the castle of Gabora on up. You would take the path of the chariot, and that would be on up to Binah. Now, that bridge spans a chasm. It leads out from the edge of a cliff, the chasm, out to the castle on the pinnacle of rock. And the castle, of course, is the castle of Gabora. It's very much of a fortress, and it is ruled by the goddess of war, Anath, who we dealt with last week, if I recall, and her attributes and what she has to impart to you and also what she has to give you. Now, Anath is the presage of Astarte. She is the warrior goddess of the Canaanites and the Phoenicians. And back in times before Solomon, the era of the judges of Israel, and we're going to get into that a little bit. But one thing I want to make clear again before we get any further is that path workings can, in some instances, you know, not with us, but I mean, with other people with path workings, they can get too wrapped up in the symbolism of the path and forget about the sphere. Now, we don't do that. When we do a path working, we take the path and we master the obstacles and learn the lessons on the path, but then we enter the sphere and we have the most significant experiences in the sphere itself. Now, the reason why we do this is because, for one thing, we are aware that there was far too much emphasis placed on the paths and not enough emphasis placed on the spheres in the Golden Dawn system. And one of the reasons for that was that Eliphas Levi, who was a tremendous influence on the Golden Dawn, Eliphas Levi actually believed that the tarot, especially the trumps, preceded the Kabbalah. He thought the Tree of Life, the Kabbalah, the grand old Kabbalah of the Zohar, and even the Sefer Yetzirah, that was derived originally from the tarot trumps. Oh boy! Well, we know that isn't true, but that's what he believed. Eliphas Levi was quite a romantic, and so that carried through. I mean, this idea of Eliphas Levi's carried through, and. So there is, and he was the one, of course, who originally applied the tarot to the Tree of Life, to the Kabbalah. And before Levi, that was really just beginning to get at the yellow of some of them. We're just beginning to get an idea of matching up the Kabbalah. But Levi went ahead and got the bit in his teeth, and he's the one who put tarot cards on the paths and link them up to the astrological signs and the planets and the elements and the letters of the Hebrew alphabet and created the structure. In the course of doing that, so much of the operative symbolism was given to the paths and the spheres they went to became passive. And the paths became active. Now, I don't think that this is a balanced system. It's not a balanced way to do it. So always, whenever we do a path working in the OTA, we always, and in the ORC, we always have our supreme experience in the path working will be in the sphere itself. I want you to remember that now. So this path of Lamed, this 22nd path, is going to lead us right to that bridge, the same bridge that we went on the path of the Hanged Man, coming up from Hod. Same bridge. We're going to get to the same spot. We're just going to take a different direction, walking up to the same spot. But it's going to be the same bridge. And interestingly enough, this is not John Michael Greer symbolism at all, but he's mentioning, see, experiences of the path, narrow bridges, oh boy. And this is a narrow bridge, and it has the bridge leading over there has no rails, it's narrow, it's a bottomless chasm on either side, and you're going to have to, it's like Little John and Robin Hood, you know, meeting in the middle of this bridge with the guardian, so you have that to worry about or look forward to or whatever. That's part of both the path of the Hanged Man leading on up, 23rd, and this path coming across from Tiberath, the 22nd. Now, we mentioned that in the abstract that we were going to take you on a journey to Osiris's Hall of Judgment. Well, yep, we're going to have to, because that's part of what this path represents. That's part of it. And by the way, in the Golden Dawn, on the pillars in the Golden Dawn Temple, you have the hieroglyphic display and the iconographic display of this Hall of Judgment from Egyptian mythology. And what this amounts to, and just to do a little revealing here, by the way, the Phoenicians and the Egyptians had a lot of interchangeable mythology, and had their Egyptian gods and Phoenician gods were interacting in each other. Kusar, who invented the fishing boat, is also almost interchangeable with both Hermes. In fact, at one point in Phoenician mythology, they went down to Egypt to get Kusar to bring him back for a council of the gods. So I'm not saying that Osiris and the Hall of Judgment is Phoenician mythology, but the Phoenicians were very familiar with it, and they probably even incorporated aspects of it in the Phoenician mythology. Now, what it amounts to is this. Osiris, as you all know, or should know, was murdered, stealthily murdered, by his evil brother, Set, the Typhon monster, or whatever you want to call him. He lured Osiris into this coffin and was going to give him this really fine coffin, and he wanted to see if it fit Osiris, and he got him in the coffin. Of course, he got him in the coffin and murdered him and smothered him to death and whatever. So then Osiris, instead of being resurrected like a year king, although he had some of those attributes, he's just sometimes pictured as green, but instead of being resurrected to come back with the spring planting or whatever, like Baal does, instead of that, Osiris went up to the what the Egyptian version of heaven. He went up to the outer world, I mean to the spiritual realm, and he there judged the dead, when the spirits of the dead would come to the Hall of Judgment, Osiris would sit in judgment. And Anubis, of course, the god of death, would lead them into the Hall of Judgment. Now, if you had been good and moral and charitable and honest and true and all of that, then you would go on to the Egyptian counterpart to paradise. And if you were not, trap door opened and you dropped down into the pit and into the gullet of the crocodile, or in some versions a monster, but you know, quite often a crocodile. And this is probably where James Berry got the idea for the crocodile that followed Captain Hook along, you know, and had the clock ticking in his belly, and that's probably where that came from. But the important thing here is the scales. This is what relates this to the scale. Your soul and your deeds were judged against a feather. A feather on one side of the scale, and your deeds and your sins and everything else on the other side. And if they were any heavier than that feather, you are in trouble. And it was crocodile time. Now, you can see that this is in a sense, spiritual justice. Now, the justice card, as it's pictured in most instances, especially in the white deck, or the case deck, or whatever, you notice that justice is female, sitting there holding her sword in front, and the scales in one hand and the sword in the other. But in this tarot card, this is a point that John Michael Greer makes, that in this tarot card, she's not blindfolded. like we have in our version of the statue in Washington. This, in the tarot card, she's not blindfolded. Why? Because this is a spiritual judgment, and there's no need to blindfold the judge in this case, because the judge sees and knows. That's a very important point. Now, let's talk about this justice, because the main thing here is the Hall of Justice and Osiris, and this analogy of the spiritual nature of the judgment. Now, this is important for a number of reasons. And this is a point that both Basil Welby, S. Garrett Knight, and John Michael Greer both make this point, that justice, like evil, is in the eye of the beholder. Justice, like evil, is subject to different interpretations. And what some people think is justice, other people think is a terrible travesty of justice. Now, to give you an example, this is an example pretty close to home. We have in this country right now, today, we have a serious divide. And it's not just political, it's also spiritual. And the divide is between those who believe in the goodness and the necessity and the rightness of a complete welfare state, complete socialistic welfare state, and those who with equal fervor and equal righteous feeling believe in a free market, laissez-faire capitalism, and the idea that the greatest good for the greatest number will be achieved by complete freedom of action and success and acquisition of property and all of that. And both of these positions look at justice in different ways, very different ways. And in fact, it is difficult for the political conservative and the political liberal, especially if they're fervently committed on either side, it's difficult for them to understand how the mind of the other one works. And some of the things that the conservative thinks are almost wholly sanctified rights of the human being, and freedom and dignity and all the rest of this, and opportunity and all these things that they think are almost sanctified rights, the ultra-liberal or the atheist thinks that they're terribly wrong and they're even sinful. So what's justice? The mind, the mindset of these people, the political, spiritual, and everything else. Now, it doesn't do any good to remind some of these conservatives, these arch-conservatives, that Jesus preached what to some people seems like a form of communism. I mean, yeah, but and these people profess to be devout Christians, and then the liberals look at devout Christians almost as if they were somehow or other that was where they were deriving their conservatism from, and the whole thing is all twisted up. It's what's justice? What is it? What's right? And really, I'm not going to try to make a decision one way or the other on this, in this broadcast, in this discussion. I'm not, because I know that I have friends who are left-wing liberals, and sometimes they exasperate me with some of their extremism. But I realize that to them, this is moral. This is this is, you know, they really believe that this is the right thing. This is moral. And I have friends who are arch conservatives and whatever, and some of their extremes are, to me, seem to be just as misplaced and as wrong. But I also understand that they firmly believe that this is right. So, what's the criteria? What's justice?
Yeah.
Is where you have to look at this with eyes that are above your own personal prejudices. You have to look and think that, you got a call. Oh, you're on the Hermetic Hour. Who am I talking with? You're on the Hermetic Hour. Who am I speaking with? Not going to speak?
Well, breathe at me.
Oh, come on. I guess he just wants to listen. All right. Anyway, I don't want to offend either
end of the political spectrum here. I'm trying to be nice to both of you.
But still, this is something that cosmic consciousness, this is Ken Kesey talked about this, rising up above the psychic center, what we would call the Hesed Center, up in the third eye area, where you could take a cosmic look at this. Remember, Ken Kesey used to use an example of how he would say as you go up the various centers, the boss fired Ken. All right, so
down there in your son or something. Oh my God, the boss fired. Oh, he's panicking,
and then he gets up a little bit higher and up in the hood, and he says, "Oh, the boss fired me." Oh, and he's mad, and when he gets up to Gabura, but he's really furious. But then when he gets up to Hesed, now he didn't use these particular terms for the psychic centers, but he gets up there and he says, "Oh, the boss fired Ken." See, he's gotten beyond his personal feelings there. He's looking at this thing from standpoint. Sometimes it's good to use the analogy if you are a rational humanist rather than an occultist, and some of us are occultists, happen to be rational humanists too. It's good to take the Martian perspective. Now, when I say that, I do not mean a perspective of Tarsarkus the Thark or Deja Thoris or anything. That's not the Martians I'm talking about. I'm talking about a hypothetical Martian who is very advanced and looking at Earth people as from sort of a detached point of view, and thinking about or observing what we consider to be morality and what we consider to be the moral issues and what we consider to be the way we should feel about poverty and about crime and about engrossment. By the way, that's an interesting word, engrossment. We don't use that word anymore. That's something to think about, isn't it? A wonderful word. I mean, or a terrible word, actually. It means cornering the market on an essential commodity and then jacking the price up. And it used to be back in the 18th, 19th century, early 19th century, it was a crime, and it was punishable during the colonial times, it was punishable by pillory and ruin. Yeah. We don't even use the word anymore. Why? Because it's become, engrossment has become something nice. It's become something acceptable. Oh, yeah. Remember Enron? Oh, boy. Yeah. And so the word's been eliminated from our language. Just like the word loan, the two words loan shark. You never hear that anymore. Those words have been taken out of the language. Why? Because the biggest banks in the country are charging what they would have gone to jail for back when we used the term loan shark. That's why. So what is justice? What is a crime for some? Is it's a rightful expression of freedom for others? Now, I said in the abstract preamble that we were going to deal with a biblical Canaanite mystery that relates to this path. And we're going to reveal this for the first time. I think we probably are revealing this for the first time because I've read a lot of material on the Tree of Life and on the symbolism and whatever, and I've never run across this analogy. But I want you to really, really kind of consider this. In the Bible, remember, he asked George Patton one time if he read the Bible, and he said, yeah, every goddamn day. But anyway, so I'm not quite like George. I don't read it every day, but I do read it. if General Dick, if you're listening. But anyway, now, in the Bible, in the book of Judges, which, of course, you know, came along sometime before Samson, by the way. In the book of Judges, after Ehud, the judge Ehud, and by the way, if you're interested in Ehud, and this fits right in with what we're talking about, Ehud was a judge of Israel, and that's, let's see, what chapter is that, Ehud? Judges 3, and Ehud, he brought a message of God to the king of Moab, and a message from God, and he got the king of Moab in to his private chamber to deliver this private message from God to him, and the king of Moab was a rather fat, pretty fat. And Judge Ehud, he drew out the dagger from under his big dagger, and he plunged it into the king of Moab's tummy. And he was so fat, and the dagger was getting him all the way, and he ended up kind of really messing up the king of Moab. And that was his message from God. And then he left him in there and locked up his summer house and left him in there and made his... Now, Ehud was a judge of Israel, so, what's justice? Okay, well, that's Ehud. But after Ehud, there was a judge, and I'll read it. This is 31, right before the end of the chapter, in chapter 3. And after him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, which slew of the Philistines 600 men with an ox goad. And he also delivered Israel. Okay. Shamgar, oh boy, I'm trying to get Friar Solomon to write an epic on Shamgar, sort of like my Prince of Cotton, the Magic Bow, but because Shamgar was Canaanite. And he was Canaanite who became a Jewish judge. And he was a son of Anath. Now, Anath is the Canaanite Phoenician warrior goddess who lives in the palace, in one of the castles of Deborah. And she was quite a ferocious goddess. Used to wear a girdle of human hands and a necklace of human heads, very much like Kali. And she was also referred to as virgin goddess. Well, she couldn't very well have had a son, but this is quite interesting because usually these godlings, these demigods, are sired by a male father who is a god upon a female mother who is immortal. That's the way it usually happens. But in this case, Shamgar is the son of the warrior goddess, Anar.
Oh, boy.
Now, if you know very much about Anath from mythology and all, she's not I don't see her. Yeah, she could, because Ishtar, you know, did that occasionally. And she is kind of an Ishtar cognate. But in all probability, Shamgar was the daughter, was the son of a priestess of Anath, who probably didn't want the kid hanging around and did like Sargon ended up, and then they, you know, Ezra and Cyrus borrowed that story and applied it to Moses, but Sargon got put in a wicker basket and floated down the river. And so probably, in looking at this thing realistically, Shamgar was probably the illegitimate son of a priestess, probably a high priestess of the Temple of Anath. Now, he slays kind of a presage of Samson, but instead of using the jawbone of an ass, he uses an ox goad, which turns out to be the symbolism of the letter Lamed, which is attributed to this path. And then, of course, Anath is the warrior goddess of Gomorrah. And so this is really kind of, and Shamgar becomes a judge. So we're starting to hit all the bases here on this path with Shamgar. Now, let me talk about an ox goad a little bit. I think most of you kind of have an idea what an ox goad looks like. It's kind of like a boat hook, except it's sharp. Both the hook is sharp and the point is sharp. And if this is made out of Hittite iron, which it probably was, this would be one fearsome weapon. And so Shamgar, 600 Philistines is a lot of Philistines. He must have had them. Maybe he got them all drunk. And Philistines had a way of doing that. He might have gotten them all drunk and you know, done like Grendel did with the Vikings, you know, and just wait till they were all drunk and then go in and do them in. But anyway, the ox goad is the letter Lamed, and so we need to look at the story of Shamgar and realize that here we have a real connection between Canaanite mythology and biblical mythology and justice and all. So I think Shamgar and his ox goad are definitely attributed to this path and should be a symbolism, part of the symbolism of it. Now, so we have Osiris and his scales. And I might mention too that when it comes to scales, that down in Hod, we use the scales to get up to the library, sort of as an elevator. But there, what we're doing is we're balancing. We're taking the male and the female aspects of the individual person, and personifying the opposite gender, the anima, animus, whatever, in order to individuate the individual, to get them up to the library so they can receive the knowledge in there. So that's a little different. That's not a scale of justice. Here on this path, we're dealing with scales of justice and whatever, you know, whatever justice is. At one point, backtracking a little bit, we did a show, I think it was 2 years ago or more, on the nature of evil, of what is evil. And this goes along with our idea of justice. What's evil? It's very, very hard to define evil, especially when you get these skewed perspectives, like what you think is, and according to whatever religious philosophy you have, you get a different picture of evil depending upon what your philosophy and your religion is. I give you an example. Last night I was reading, I have a great big fat book on Near Eastern mythology and legends and all this kind of stuff, which I feed myself to sleep with sometimes. And I ran across a story from the early Christians of Anatolia called Matthias and the Cannibals. Now, this is a story about a couple of Jesus's apostles. One of them is named Matthias, another one's named Andrew. And they are, Jesus wants Matthias to go to the land of the cannibals and try to convert them to Christianity, get them away from cannibalism. And he's going to suffer all these terrible things, but he's going to have to endure them. And then he's in his mission. Well, how good! This is a very gruesome story. I mean, this story is so gruesome, but by the time this story's done, Jesus himself, and well, poor Matthias doesn't do anything terrible except get awfully tortured and miserable. He doesn't do anything really bad. But by the time this story's over with, Jesus and Andrew have committed so many atrocities and so many savage, ruthless doings in their attempts to convert the cannibals, that they're worse than the cannibals. And finally, they manage to convert the cannibals, but the only way they do is to convince the cannibals that they're more ruthless and more terrible than the cannibals are. But this is apparently in the 5th century or something like this in Anatolia. These Christians, they thought this was a wonderful story. What is evil? What is morality when you look at it from this perspective? What is? And that these questions you have to ask is like Harry Truman deciding to drop the bomb on the Japanese on Hiroshima. Was this evil? Well, I don't think Harry thought so. Harry was—he certainly was tough, and he was. But he firmly believed that this would save many Japanese and American lives. He might have been right. But of course, there are a lot of very ardent humanitarians who will try, you know, twisting or bending history or interpreting history to prove that he was wrong. And, oh, no, it wouldn't have shortened the war and all the rest of this. Further. So, you don't know. You said, was that evil? I don't know. I reserve judgment on that. But the bombing of Dresden, on the other hand, for no purpose whatsoever, except just sheer gall and meanness, to blow up a city that had no military significance whatsoever, a city of art treasures and peaceful people and whatever, and just completely incinerate it and burn it to the ground and blow it up. So was Bomber Harris evil? Yes, he was, and I think so, because there was no reason. It didn't accomplish anything at all except revenge for what? Revenge for what? And because the British started bombing Germany before Germany ever bombed the British. That's not generally known. But, you know, this to me, this is an evil act. And yet, I don't know if your people would disagree with me. What's evil? What's wrong? And give me another example of differences in perspective. Colonel North, the Marine colonel who was one of the architects of the RN and facilitators of the Iran-Contra operation. This is a, well, what you call Black Op, but Colonel North volunteered to take on this mission, go down there and do this. And his boss, Admiral Poindexter, said, told him, he said, you know, he said, Ollie, if you do this, if you take this mission on, he said, I know you're worried about your wife and your kids. So he said, I will, out of my own pocket, I'll put in a security system. We'll spend about $50,000 and we'll put a security system in your house, state of the art, and protect your kids while you're gone. Don't worry about that. We'll take care of it. And that, you know, pleased Colonel North, you know, obviously. So he takes off and he does this thing. Well, now, whatever you think about the Iran-Contra thing, it certainly has, wasn't the most ethical, and certainly if any kind of black op is ethical, but I mean it was not ethical, and it was very controversial and all that. So North gets called on the carpet and by Congress, and in the course of this, they actually tried to, these people who were against him, they actually tried to make it a part of a crime. This was a criminal act that he received this security system from Poindexter, and this was a bribe. And they were going to actually charge him with this security system as receiving a bribe. What? I was absolutely flabbergasted. I could have, what kind of mental process is this? Now, whatever North was guilty of with the Iran-Contra thing, whatever he might have, whatever, but this is certainly not part of it. This, I mean, good Lord, this is an American Marine officer who's going out and doing it on a dangerous mission, and his boss is offering out of his own pocket to put in a security system for his wife and his family, and then these people that are after North, and they think this is a crime? They think this is receiving a bribe? Where are their heads? Where are their hearts? To me, this is, but see, this is different ways people look at things. And I still, for the life of me, I can't fathom that mindset at all, but and I can fathom the people who thinks Snowden did the right thing. I can fathom that. I'm not sure he did, but I mean, but I can fathom it. I can understand it. But I can't understand this thing. So it's different mindset. What's justice? What is justice? What's right? What's wrong? What's karma? And that's another aspect of this path, very definitely. This is the path of karma. This is the path where you have to start looking at karma. And then we have to ask ourselves, if you don't feel guilt about what you do, if other people think that it might be that it's terrible, but you don't, if you don't feel any guilt and you feel you've done the right thing, does that give you bad karma? I don't know. I can't answer that question for you. You have to answer that question. So think about it, and think about the scales of justice. Remember, Libra is the sign of the balance. This, that. Which way? And of course, Gabura is the sphere of action. Firm, determined action. Before you take that action, before you enter that sphere, you should examine your own prejudices, examine your own perspective. Take that cosmic view. Imagine yourself as that contemplative Martian, not Tar Circus, no, and not that transplanted Johnny Reb either. You take a detached view of a Martian, very, very out off of this world, and look and say, now what is, just what is evil? What is going to give me bad karma? And look at it that way. I hope this has given you some insight into this path. And next week, we will we'll keep going up and climbing another one. And until that time, don't forget to tune in next week. And good magic.